funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
A glimpse of a gray wolf or bison or grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park from a safe distance can be an unforgettable thrill. At various times, these animals have been nearly absent from the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, victims of human activity that killed them outright or interfered with their habitats or feeding patterns. Today, those populations have rebounded, also as a result of human intervention. But within park borders, they pose at least some risk to visitors, and some property owners beyond that world-famous and carefully managed Wyoming rectangle see them as nuisances when they stray onto ranches near private homes. Such is the paradox of the cultivated wild. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. That's journalist David Quammen's term for the animals and plants that live in Yellowstone, no longer entirely natural and never truly tame. Quammen wrote National Geographic's special May issue called Yellowstone, the Battle for the American West, and he's here to talk about it. David, welcome back to Think.
Nice to be back with you, Chris.
We want our national parks to be safe and accessible, and yet we also want the wilderness within them to be as close to wild as it can be. In places like Yellowstone, that has not been an easy line to balance.
No, it has not, and that's why I call it a paradox. Animals need space. Animals don't respect lines drawn on a map. Animals can be dangerous. Bears, mountain lions, wolves even can be dangerous. So we want to go someplace where we can see those things, or at least to know that they have been preserved, kept alive somewhere within the American, the heartland of the American West. But it's problematic. And animals don't obey human rules, but we need to. That's the paradox.
You spent a ton of time at the park and the places surrounding it, exploring it from the ground and also from the air. What can you observe from a plane that's not apparent on foot or on horseback and vice versa?
Well, yes, you're right. I spent one stretch of hours with a wonderful bush pilot named Roger Stradley, who's been flying in these mountains for about 62 years. He's got something like 70,000 hours. And he flies a lot for the park biologists who monitor the movements of grizzly bears and wolves and other animals. When they're radio tracking them, they go up with Roger, and he flies low and slowly over Yellowstone so that monitoring can be done. And one of the park biologists recommended that I take that flight, that kind of a flight with Roger. So we spent about 4 hours in his little old 1956 Piper Super Cub, which is a bush plane that's very good for flying low and slow. And we swept across these areas, some of them remote, some of them roaded, seeing bears, grizzlies on bison carcasses and groups of wolves high up on a snow patch with one bear and I think it was six or seven wolves on a snow patch. We never could figure out what sort of interaction they were having. Flying to the remote southeastern corner of Yellowstone and beyond, an area called the Thoroughfare region, and eventually flying back up to where we had started outside of Bozeman, Montana. And as we came up the Gallatin River, we saw one more very, very large grizzly bear alone on a patch of mountainside above the Gallatin River. We couldn't see what he was eating, and Roger circled and eventually determined that he seemed to be eating balsam root flowers, yellow flowers, alone on the top of this mountainside.
2 weeks ago, I spoke with Jonathan Jarvis, who is director of the National Park Service, about the choices that have to be made to allow humans and wildlife to coexist in the parks. Let's listen to what he had to say.
If you just protected the wildlife and you didn't let the public experience it, I think our support would wane over time. And so giving the public an opportunity to go to Yellowstone National Park and see bison free-ranging or wolves in the Lamar Valley, to see condors flying over the Grand Canyon, that's a once-in-a-lifetime experience for the public. And frankly, if managed well, the public are, get a little bit of education before they go in, the experience can be beneficial to both.
Last year, Yellowstone Park authorities explained that they were deeply saddened by an incident that forced them to shoot a grizzly bear. What happened?
Oh, that's a question to me.
That's
not
a question
John
to
Jarvis.
You. Yes, sorry.
Okay, I'm back with
to
you.
Live. Yes.
yes. Well, there was a fellow named Lance Crosby who was working in the park, and he went out for a solitary hike in August of last year, 2015. Was not carrying bear spray, was not with any other people, walked on a trail, and was killed. And his body partially eaten and then stashed, cached, by a female grizzly with several cubs. And because she had fed on him and because there seemed to be some evidence that she had killed him, that in an act, not just an accidental encounter, but an act of predation, there was some suggestion of that. It wasn't absolutely clear. The park managers, including Superintendent Dan Wank, made the decision that she had to die for the safety of the public, made that decision reluctantly. And they occasionally have to make that kind of decision. It's not often that a human kills a grizzly in Yellowstone National Park. Lance Crosby's was, I believe, just the seventh in the last 100 years. But when it happens, when a human does something that puts himself in jeopardy and gets killed, it puts the bear in jeopardy too. An investigation ensues, and if it's deemed that the bear is a continuing threat to humans, then the bear is, as they say, removed from the population.
So how often are there human bear encounters at Yellowstone?
Well, depending on how you define encounter, they're fairly frequent. People can go to Yellowstone expecting that there's a really good chance that they might see a grizzly bear, or at least a black bear, both of those live in Yellowstone, at a distance. And that's the way to see a grizzly bear, at a distance of 200, 300, 400 yards, or through the windows of your car. If you hike in Yellowstone, if you step off the paved roads and you walk just 100 yards into the backcountry, you are suddenly in a very wild place. And if you surprise a grizzly, particularly if you surprise a female grizzly with cubs, you are in a lot of danger. That, fortunately, does not happen very often. And when it does happen, if the humans have taken reasonable precautions, traveling in a group, taking proper care of their food if they're backpacking in the backcountry, making noise, and carrying bear spray, then those encounters generally are nonviolent. Everybody comes out of it just fine.
I saw a bear when I was at Sequoia National Park. I don't think it was a grizzly. I think it was probably a black bear.
It would have to be a black bear in Sequoia. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're not nearly as aggressive as grizzlies, correct?
That's right. They're not nearly as big, not nearly as aggressive, not nearly as dangerous. And alas, I say it would have to be a black bear in Sequoia because there are no remaining grizzlies in California. There once were, but Yellowstone is the last place in the midst of the American West where there is a viable population of grizzly bears. There's also a population up on the Canadian border in Glacier National Park and the associated wildlands.
The bear policy at Yellowstone has changed a great deal over the past century. For a time, and this just blows my mind, rangers essentially encouraged people to feed the bears with garbage.
That's right. That's right. Even the great early superintendent of Yellowstone Park, Horace Albright, one of the heroes of the National Park Service, eventually director of the National Park Service, one of John Jarvis's predecessors, Horace Albright ran Yellowstone for a stretch of 10 years, 1919 to 1929. And he said that it's very important for people to support the parks, for people to care about the parks, and in order for the mission of the Park Service to succeed, there must be an abundance of wildlife and they must be viewable. And for wildlife to be spectacle, Horace Albright said, they must be abundant and they must be tame. So he encouraged this feeding of handouts from cars, from picnic tables, to bears, including grizzly bears. And even more significantly, the policy began that bears would be allowed to feed on human refuse at the big dumps near the hotels within Yellowstone National Park. So for a stretch of decades, there was what was considered the bear show. People would come out of their hotels after dinner in the evening, and they could even sit on bleachers surrounding these natural amphitheaters around the dumps and watch 10, 12, 15, 18 grizzly bears all feeding on, heels of bread and portions of hamburger and grapefruit rinds in these dumps. It was very unnatural. It was a way for people to see bears, but eventually management philosophy shifted to more natural regulation, and the dumps in the late 60s, early 70s were completely closed, and that caused a sudden crisis for grizzly bears because they had to find new things to eat.
And this is kind of a silly thing to ask about, but that's right about the time that the Yogi Bear character came into existence. And a lot of it makes sense now, the whole, like, the meme about don't feed the bears, and it was Yellowstone Park. I guess in the late 60s, this was big news that Yellowstone was changing its policies.
It was. A couple of things had happened. Several women had been killed in Glacier National Park during the summer of, I think it was 1967, in an event that was called the Night of the Grizzlies. Unconnected events in different parts of Glacier National Park. Two women were gruesomely killed by grizzly bears. That plus something called the Leopold Report, which had been written in 1963 by Aldo Leopold's son, Starker, and a committee of other wildlife managers, had recommended moving toward more natural management, eliminating the dumps, and trying to encourage the grizzlies not to associate humans with food, to stay away from humans, to be wild again, and to live on natural foods. So the dumps were closed, but then the grizzlies faced a crisis for a period of years. In this piece, I say they were desperate and dazed and confused. They had to find new foods. They got into trouble. Some of them got killed in management actions or violent encounters. And the grizzly population fell drastically to less than 140 bears in the whole greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And then, because of that crash, the grizzly was placed was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act.
And that was in 1975. And in the years subsequent to that, the bear population really has rebounded.
That's right. A lot of things were done. Mistakes that had been made were corrected. There was bear-proofing of garbage receptacles in Yellowstone. There was an effort, certainly, to prevent people from feeding the bears, hand out to educate people better about the risks to themselves and the risks to grizzly bears from allowing bears to associate humans with food. There were great efforts to keep particularly to keep reproductive age females alive. If bears got in trouble, they were moved. They were given second chances. They were given third chances. Habitat was improved. The security of habitat was improved all throughout the ecosystem in terms of motorized travel, in terms of timber cut on the national forests. And as a result of all these efforts and more, the grizzly population slowly but steadily bounced back to a point where now there are at least 700 bears in the area of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem that is carefully monitored by the biologists, and there may be as many as 1,000 bears throughout the ecosystem.
How do you do a census on grizzly bears in a place as large as Yellowstone National Park?
Not easily. Not easily. That's a good question. Bears are hard to count. Wild animals generally are hard to count, but wild animals that are secretive and live in forests are especially hard to count. There is an organization called the Interagency Grizzly Bear Study Team, which is composed of biologists from various different agencies with one leader running the team. And they radio track bears, they count bears, and they use elaborate population models to estimate the number of bears in Yellowstone.
It
can only be an estimate.
We're speaking with journalist David Qualman, who wrote the entire special May issue of National Geographic on Yellowstone. It's called Yellowstone, the Battle for the American West. We will resume our conversation in a couple of minutes, and you can join it at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
We don't have any authority beyond the boundaries, but we look at our parks as sort of the anchor store of a larger ecosystem, for lack of a better term, sort of the core of that. So if you look at Yellowstone as the center of the Yellowstone ecosystem, obviously species are migrating in and out, like bison or elk or grizzly bears. And so we hope to have, through partnerships and working with states and other land managers, to have some influence over that, and particularly for migratory corridors. So one of the great iconic species of the West are the pronghorn antelope, and they have a seasonal migration sort of in and out of the Tetons out into Wyoming. And we want to make sure that that route is safe for them. There are no barriers. So working with landowners, say cattlemen, to make sure the fence is designed in such a way that pronghorn can pass through it, or if there's a major highway, creating a over or underpass for wildlife. So I really think that the core of conservation in the future, in our second century, is all going to be about sort of landscape level connectivity. And the Park Service can play a significant role in assisting that.
That, once again, was National Park Service Director Jonathan Jarvis from the interview that we had with him 2 weeks ago. This is Think on KERA. If you'd like to hear that interview in its entirety, there's a link to it on the Think page. For now, my guest is journalist David Quammen, who wrote National Geographic's special May issue called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. David, as all people in political positions are, Director Jarvis was quite diplomatic there in describing attempts to work with neighboring landowners. It hasn't always been easy for both sides to agree on just how much the influence of the Park Service should extend beyond its borders.
That's right. It hasn't been. And Yellowstone, the Yellowstone ecosystem, is a case in point. There are animals that migrate out of Yellowstone Park during the winter, because Yellowstone Park sits at a very high elevation. Most of it's above 8,000 or 9,000 feet. It's the Yellowstone Plateau, sits on top of a great volcanic hotspot. So because of the hotness underneath, it's very cold on top, especially in the winter, because it's so high. So bison migrate out of the park across the boundary into the state of Montana. Elk migrate out of the park to their winter range in lowlands on all sides of the park, 9 distinct herds of elk migrating out, and they go onto private lands. And carnivorous animals, too. Wolves travel across the boundaries of the park into Montana, into Wyoming. Bears don't respect those boundaries particularly either, but the bison, the elk, and the pronghorn, as John Jarvis mentioned, are the ungulate species that must migrate to find seasonally appropriate habitat and food. And those long migrations are like pulse beats moving in and out of the core of the Yellowstone ecosystem, absolutely crucial to many other creatures. And those migrating pulse beats are dependent on the lands, including the private lands that constitute the periphery of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And those private lands are a very important part of the whole thing and a thorny issue for park managers.
And to be fair, there are people raising cattle in the region, and they have a real vested interest in keeping bison from mingling with their herds.
They do. The bison is a very peculiar part of this picture, because stock growers in Montana are concerned about the bison because the bison carries a disease known as brucellosis. Now, brucellosis was originally a European cattle disease brought to the American West by cattle. It was transmitted to bison, also transmitted to elk. It's a bacterial disease that causes calves, particularly the calves of domestic livestock, to abort in the female. And that's costly to livestock raisers. And Montana tries to maintain a categorically brucellosis-free status, which has legal and commercial implications. So ranchers in Montana are very wary of the bison, and yet bison are not allowed to migrate freely out of Yellowstone Park onto the state of Montana, even onto national forest lands and state lands. They're stopped. They're rounded up. They're shipped to slaughter. The meat given to tribal organizations, which is a good thing, making the best of a bad thing. But that bar against the bison does nothing to stop the elk from migrating over the boundaries too. So it's sort of paradoxical, or at least to put it politely, peculiar that there should be so much concern not to let bison migrate freely out of Yellowstone and be wildlife in the state of Montana, while elk do migrate out, also carrying brucellosis. Hmm. By the way, there's never been a proven case of bison transmitting brucellosis to domestic cows, but there's a concern that it might happen.
Lots of people who care about the greater Yellowstone ecosystem have less sympathy, even less sympathy, for people who maybe have a spare $2 or $3 million to throw around and want to build, say, a summer cabin there, a summer home.
That's right. I suppose I put myself in that category, having not so much sympathy for that. The private lands that constitute some of this important winter range for elk that I was talking about, many of those private lands are large old ranches, including the ranch that Buffalo Bill Cody himself founded on the Cody side, Cody, Wyoming side of the park. These big private ranches, some of them at least, are blessedly hospitable to migrating elk and other animals that migrate out of Yellowstone. The elk come down, they get on the private ranches or on the grazing allotments of the private ranches, and they eat grass. They eat grass that the ranchers would really prefer to save for their own cattle. But some of these ranchers are very generously progressive in their views about the value of wildlife as well as their own efforts to make a living. And they let these animals do that. If those big private ranches are sold off with generational changes and subdivided and turned into sprawl, turned into more suburbs of Cody, Wyoming, or of Bozeman, Montana, where I live, then there's a great loss to the whole Yellowstone ecosystem, to the functioning of the ecosystem, to the movement of these migrating herds that need those large, intact private lands, even if they're cattle ranches, rather than ranchettes, small places with a few hundred acres and a cabin and a barking dog and a driveway. So that's one of the big battles facing conservationists and ranchers in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. The effort to keep those large private lands intact rather than turning them into, as I say in the piece, just a big boring suburb with antler motif doorknobs.
If Yellowstone proper has been an effective wildlife refuge, now that it's being managed, you know, by the best practices of contemporary, wildlife management, why are there still concerns about the long-term health of species there? Is it because it's just the park?
It's not just the park, it's the entire ecosystem. But and the park is not an island. The park is part of this great amoeboid expanse. Yellowstone Park is about 2 million acres. The greater Yellowstone ecosystem is about 20 to 22 million acres, depending on how you draw the outlines of the amoeba. So 10 times as large. But the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is an ecological island surrounded by the modern West, surrounded by interstate highways and towns like Cody and Bozeman and ranch lands, lowlands, suburbs, strip malls, golf courses, Starbucks. So the animals, at least the non-flying animals that live in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, are insularized. And if there are not enough of them within this particular island, then what happens to them is what tends to happen to all creatures that live isolated on islands, which is that their populations fluctuate, their populations may not be large enough, and sometimes the populations fluctuate to zero, and therefore you have an extinction of a species on that island. That's the concern for some of the creatures within Yellowstone, including the grizzly bear.
I had not given very much thought at all to the effect of invasive species on natural park habitats until I read your piece. The story of the cutthroat trout is a chilling example of something that maybe wasn't meant to do any harm.
That's right. Invasive species are a huge problem throughout the country, throughout the world, but in particular in Yellowstone. Invasive species of plants, We call those weeds, and invasive species of animals. You could call those weeds too. Someone planted lake trout, which is a large trout, large aggressive trout from the Midwest, from the Great Lakes. Someone planted lake trout in Yellowstone Lake. This happened probably back in the 1980s. Somebody with a bucket thinking that wouldn't it be nice to have lake trout in Yellowstone Lake? The problem was there already was a species of trout, the cutthroat trout, living in Yellowstone Lake. And the explosion of the population of the lake trout when it found this wonderful new habitat resulted in the collapse of the population of the cutthroat trout. So the cutthroat trout has nearly disappeared. It's still holding on in Yellowstone Lake, but there are implications for other animals. For instance, cutthroat trout spawn by swimming up the little streams that feed into Yellowstone Lake. And by going into those little streams to spawn in the spring, they make themselves available to fish-eating animals, including grizzly bears, including eagles, including coyotes, including a lot of other things. Now that the population has crashed in Yellowstone, that's no longer happening, those massive spawning runs of cutthroat. Lake trout don't run up into little streams to spawn. They spawn in the depths of the lake. So suddenly, this important source of food to grizzlies and some other animals has virtually disappeared. The Park Service, it has to be said, the Park Service is making great efforts to mitigate that problem by catching and killing large numbers of lake trout to try to allow the cutthroat to bounce back.
So if you're a fisherman and you head to Yellowstone and you happen to pull a lake trout out, you have to keep it. And I guess you don't have to eat it, but you can't throw it back in.
That's right. It's mandatory that you kill these invasives, these lake trouts. Now, some people say, you know, lake trout, it's a beautiful fish. It is a beautiful fish, but it's a fish in the wrong place. And the result of this movement of an invasive species, as always results from invasive species, is loss of diversity in the ecosystem among native species, some of which are very localized and can't live just everywhere the way weedy species do. So it's an ecological judgment that we would rather have these relatively narrowly distributed native species than another species that can live in a lot of different places.
We haven't talked much yet about the reintroduction of gray wolves, but they are another success story.
They are indeed. Wolves were eradicated from the Yellowstone area, as through most of the American West, in the early 20th century. The last wolf in Yellowstone was probably killed sometime in the 1930s. And then in 1995, gray wolves that had been trapped and brought down from Canada were soft released in Yellowstone in the Lamar Valley. And what I mean by soft released is that they were put in holding pens for a period of time so they could acclimate to this new area. And they were fed in these large holding pens, several acres. And then eventually the gates of those holding pens were opened and the wolves were allowed to roam out. Some of them left the park. Most of them stayed, found that they could make a living here, and the gray wolf has now recovered in the northern Rockies. There are about 100, constituting 10 packs, Yellowstone Park, about 500 wolves throughout the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and about 1,300 more in other parts of the northern Rockies now. It's been a great recovery, great success story, not without controversy, not without people who still oppose wolves.
Oppose wolves simply because they're frightened of them?
No, oppose wolves because wolves prey on livestock when their natural prey is not there.
Hmm.
So there are large areas of Montana, for instance, where wolves are roaming around. There aren't that many elk or deer left in some of those areas. The wolves are attracted down to cattle on people's private lands, and they kill cattle. And if you're a rancher, it's a genuine concern. You have to have some sympathy for those people. There have been costs to some people more than to others of bringing the wolf back to the Northern Rockies. We as a society, we as a community, should do our very best to assume as much of those costs as we can so that we who enjoy the benefits of the return of the wolf would also be paying a large portion of the costs.
There's been a real, I guess, zigzag pattern in the population of elk at Yellowstone. What accounts for that?
Well, there are some natural fluctuations, as I mentioned. Those might have to do with weather and hard years, et cetera. But there has also been great fluctuation in management philosophy. Hmm. There are always some people who think there are too many elk in the Yellowstone ecosystem and people who think there are too few. Hunters love elk. So for hunters, there always should be more elk. Ranchers do not particularly like elk because they compete for grass, compete with their own livestock. So there has been this fluctuation back and forth. Likewise, inside the park, I mentioned Horace Albright, that great early superintendent who thought that wildlife should be abundant and tame. He also felt that there was good wildlife and bad wildlife. Good animals were those wild animals that people enjoyed looking at and that were gentle and that mostly were herbivorous, and that included deer and elk and pronghorn. It also included trout. People liked to fish for trout, so trout were popular. You know, anything that preyed upon those species, mountain lion, coyote, wolf, pelicans preyed on trout, all of those animals were persecuted for decades in Yellowstone Park as official policy. And then with the wolves and the mountain lions gone and the bear population down, elk populations exploded, and then they decided there were too many elk, so there were official persecutions of the elk population, or there were culls. So there has been this constant fluctuation. We decide this animal is good, so we want more of it, and then we say, whoops, there are too many. We got to remove some of those. How do we do it? And since the Leopold Report in the 1960s, we have tried to do less of that. It still goes on, but we have tried to buffer as much as possible those changes in strategy, those intrusive management activities, and to some degree let the animal populations regulate one another.
David Qualman is my guest. He wrote National Geographic's special May issue called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by finding me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist David Qualman. He wrote National Geographic's special May issue called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. David, in your opinion, does the Parks Department have the management right now? Are the choices being made to conserve wildlife, to take care of the environment, and allow human visitors to benefit? Is it as balanced as it could be?
I think it's very well balanced. I think very highly of the professionals in charge of the National Park Service, and in particular of Yellowstone right now. But their job keeps changing. I think that, for instance, Dan Wenk, superintendent of Yellowstone Park, he's a great public servant, a great parks manager. I think he's got one of the hardest jobs in America. So is everything being done that needs to be done? Is everything being done that is going to need to be done in the future? No. And I think Dan Wenk himself would be the first to admit that. He's going to be facing new and more difficult problems soon. For instance, the question of delisting the grizzly bear, that's really on his plate and on the plate of others right now. Taking the grizzly off of the endangered species list, what are the implications for that? If it happens, how would it be done? What would be the effect on the grizzly population? But not just that. There's also the human population. Yellowstone had 4 million visitors last year. Grand Teton National Park, also part of the ecosystem, had more than 3 million visitors. There are parts of Yellowstone that just become a traffic jam in the middle of summer if a grizzly bear happens along the road and everyone slams on their brakes and stops and wants to see it. not everyone who wants to go to Yellowstone in the future probably will be able to drive his or her personal car in. It may be that people show up to Yellowstone and everyone is greeted with, well, thank you, welcome to Yellowstone, park your car over there and please get on the shuttle. That's going to be a difficult political decision. But Dan Wenk, and he's told me this, he foresees a time in the not too distant future when he'll have to engage with that. With that problem, question of whether or not there should be more hotels and hotel rooms built in Yellowstone. My impression is that he doesn't want to do that. He recognizes that the resource of wildness in Yellowstone is finite, and you cannot increase that in response to increasing demand. So there will come a need to control the demand because the supply cannot be increased. That's already happening in places like smaller parks like Yosemite and Zion, Bryce Canyon National Park. It's probably going to have to happen soon in Yellowstone, and it'll take the wisdom of the public supporting that sort of difficult decision for it to become workable.
I want to go back to one more cut from my conversation with John Jarvis, the director of the National Park Service. I asked him about evidence of climate change.
We see pretty significant evidence of climate change in a number of parks. Glacier National Park up in Montana is kind of the poster child. We predict within 20, 25 years there will be no glaciers in Glacier National Park, and that will have significant downstream effects to wildlife fisheries. We're seeing fires burn now at least a month longer, the fire season beginning earlier, ending later, and fires burning much more intensely, stand replacing, and new species coming in. And we're also seeing species migrate, arriving in parks that we had not seen before as well. So there are a number of very significant impacts happening from climate change in the national parks already.
David Quammen, what changes have you observed at Yellowstone over the years?
Well, one of the changes related to what John said that stands out most is the effect of climate change, or the probable effect of climate change, on whitebark pine trees. Whitebarks are a type of pine that lives at high elevations, 8,000, 9,000 feet. They live up there and only up there because they don't compete well with other pine trees that do well at lower elevations, with lodgepole pine and Douglas fir and other conifers. So the whitebark are up there escaping competition, living in this very difficult, cold, severe highland environment, and they grow cones that contain seeds, referred to as whitebark pine nuts, but they're really seeds that are high in fat and that are an important food for the grizzly bear, and also for some birds, for squirrels, for a whole series of animals. But for the grizzly, this is one of the four main foods that have been most important to the grizzly since the closing of the dumps in the late 60s. And now the whitebark pines are dying off. Large numbers of them have died off because of a beetle, an infestations of the mountain pine beetle that have been killing off whitebarks at the high elevations. Infestations of mountain pine beetle have always come and gone, but usually they ended after a relatively brief period of infestation and the whitebark populations could recover. More recently, in the last 10 to 15 years, there have been continuous outbreaks of relatively high densities of mountain pine beetle because the cold temperatures that formerly killed off these infestations, especially cold temperatures, really cold temperatures occurring in early winter and early spring, those cold snaps have not been happening. So the whitebark pine beetle infestations have not been brought under control, and lots of whitebarks are dying. The biologists differ on what the implications of that will be for grizzly bears, who have eaten a lot of those whitebark pine seeds in the past. But at least it will cause grizzlies, or force grizzlies, to adapt, to adjust, to look for other kinds of food as one of the high caloric items in their diet.
for now, grizzlies are, I guess, fattening up on cutworm moths?
Army cutworm moths are another unexpected but very important food for the grizzly, one of the four major foods that I mentioned. Army cutworm moths are a kind of moth that is a crop pest in the Midwest. These things fly in from the Great Plains, from Kansas and Nebraska. They migrate during the summer to escape the heat. As larvae, as caterpillars, they feed on the roots of crop plants in the Midwest, and then when things get hot and dry, they fly to Yellowstone. They fly to the Absaroka Mountains in particular, along the east margin of the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, go up to about 10,000 feet, and they spend their days down in the rocks. We call them scree slopes, these big broken up fields of rock where it's cool and damp. They come out at night to feed on nectar from alpine wildflowers. And grizzlies feed on these things in huge numbers. They go into these scree piles and turn over 40, 50-pound rocks, eating thousands and thousands of these cutworm moths. You might see, it's almost like the dumps in the old era. You might see 6, 8, or 10 grizzlies all relatively close to one another feeding away on these moths. This, I find, is one of the things about the ecology of Yellowstone, the Yellowstone ecosystem, that's most surprising to people, that one of the major foods of the Yellowstone grizzly is this kind of moth.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Chris in Tyler. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how's it going this afternoon?
Great, thank you.
Hey, so I had a comment for your guest. My wife and I were in the park in Yellowstone from the 5th through the 9th last summer and had an excellent grizzly experience in the Hayden Valley. A mother with two first-year cubs had acquired a bison carcass, and the park rangers weren't exactly sure how the bison died. It may have been wolves, but it certainly wasn't a vehicle impact. And we had the pleasure of going every morning and every evening and watching this mother and two cubs from about 120 yards away just do their thing. The cubs would nap, and she would feed, and she would lay down for a bit, and the cubs would feed. And it was an absolutely beautiful experience, except despite the park rangers being there and the cones set up blocking people, you know, sort of setting off a barrier, people continued to walk through them and approach the bears. I mean, people got within 50 or 60 yards while the entire crowd of 120, 200 people were yelling and screaming at the top of their lungs. And so, you know, in my opinion, I think the biggest challenge to the park is definitely going to be the National Park Service continuing to further educate the visitors and prevent the visitors from causing negative interactions with the wildlife. And I just kind of wanted to get your guest's comment on that.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, yeah, thank you, Chris. That's a good comment. That is a very, very archetypal Yellowstone experience. And it's it represents an explosive situation that could really go wrong quickly for humans and then therefore for that female with her cubs. It's a huge frustration to the park rangers, I'm sure, when that sort of thing happens. They did not sign up primarily because they wanted to do crowd control. But crowd control is what they have to do in those kinds of situations. And sometimes the clearest and the most stern remonstrations of the rangers and the hollering by other people who know better, as you say, is not enough to keep some people from doing really dumb things that could get them killed and could get a grizzly bear killed. So there needs to be more public education, and frankly, there needs to be more multilingual public education and signage, because more and more visitors to Yellowstone Park are international. There might need to be signs in Chinese in the Hayden Valley saying, "Do not approach bears. They are wild animals. You could get yourself killed and them killed too." We might need signs in Mandarin saying that.
Do you think it's interesting that you mentioned, you know, that we need signs written in a variety of languages? I would think that some of the people who make really poor choices would be Americans who assume, well, it's a park and therefore I can't possibly get hurt here.
Well, that's certainly true, that some of them are Americans who believe exactly that, who believe it's a park. They think it's somehow a controlled environment. They think of it as a great diorama, as though it were behind a plexiglass window. But again, as I say in the piece, it's not a diorama. The diorama is real, and the plexiglass window is not there. If you step off the road and walk 50 yards halfway to a female grizzly with cubs feeding on a bison carcass, you might as well be playing Russian roulette with a revolver and put two live shells in it instead of just one. It's an enormously dangerous thing to do. People do it because they don't know better, or because they are insistently selfish in wanting to get that great photo, to wanting to get closer than other people, wanting to get this great experience. But it also is true that there are more and more people from other countries visiting the park, and some of them have different cultural standards, different cultural expectations. And I've heard from Dan Wank, the superintendent, and others that this is a serious problem with dealing with cross-cultural expectations and language gaps in terms of the visitors to Yellowstone and how they behave.
So, David, I hear a lot of passion in your voice. I know that this is a place that you personally have a great love for. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship to Yellowstone?
Sure. It does mean a lot to me. I have lived in the ecosystem for a little more than 30 years. I've lived in Montana for 40-some years. I've gone to Yellowstone a lot to drink at this spring of wildness. I spent my 30th birthday on skis in the backcountry of Slough Creek, and I spent my 40th birthday on skis in the backcountry of Slough Creek. That was in February of whatever, 78 and 88. And I still love to go into the backcountry during winter with biologists on skis. I care about this place, and I care about the survival of this viable population of grizzly bears at the heart of the American West. Seems to me there's no more precious and extraordinary value of Yellowstone, for all its many values, than the fact that it does preserve a population of America's most magnificent and dangerous land animal, the grizzly bear, in the heart of the American West. That's extraordinary in the early decades of the 21st century, and I hope it's somehow allowed to survive into the early decades of the next century.
Journalist David Qualman wrote National Geographic's special May issue called Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us today.
Chris, it's a pleasure for me, too. I really appreciate it, and thanks for your interest.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.